I'd like to give you Tom, and I think you'll really enjoy what he has to say.
Thank you, Susie. I'm Tom. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the group for inviting me to come speak, and Patrick for making the connection. Thank you to a couple of friendly faces. I dragged some people along for the ride here from my home group and my sponsees. I'll just tell you right up front, I'm a little nervous. This is, you know, Susie gave me a really, really big buildup, and you know, Patrick made a flyer. You know, I am an alcoholic though. You know, and I am, you know, a lay person. I'm not published. You know, I recorded some speaking engagements I had just to share with some people. I am not trained professionally. My experience is of an alcoholic and addict in ACOA and Al-Anon and all kinds of other things thrown in there. So my experience is practical experience. I've read quite a bit. I've tried to learn as much about alcoholism recovery and spirituality along the way, but it's essential, you know, practical experience. So hopefully that comes through in my talk and that helps you. I do have what I would consider a decent emotional recovery working knowledge of how to use these steps to untangle myself from the dependencies and my past and the things I used to get hung up on that would cause me trouble and trouble with, you know, with capital T, as they say, in terms of things that would dominate me, and to the point where if I had not gotten relief through some manner of working steps, I could have gone back out to drinking because I've been refining myself over the years and continue the work. I don't get as caught up anymore. And that's emotional sobriety. So for me, I know that you've heard some other presenters before, and certainly Alan has done a wonderful job of presenting this over the years and refining it. And for my own purpose, what I consider emotional sobriety or emotional recovery for me is that I'm no longer driven by my past. My past does not dominate me the way it used to. The things that happen to me are simply things that happen to me. They're no longer my current motivators, my current emotional state. I've also learned how to respond rather than react. That's something I didn't know I had an option to do, which used to be something would happen, a thought, an emotion would happen, and I would just fire right back. And nowadays, I respond a lot more than I just react. And when I do respond, most times, again, I'll couch this, I'm still a work in progress, I have a proportional response. That means I'm not reacting out of context and out of hand to what I'm experiencing in the moment. If anyone can, you know, relate, you know, the broken shoelace, which creates a screaming fit, you know, a problem that, you know, at work, you know, causing me to, you know, throw my keyboard across the room. Those are emotional outbursts, which are not in proportion. And so I've learned how to bring myself to a place where I can proportionally respond to life. And as described in Bills 12 and 12, this is actually on page 91. I like this and I picked it out. Like, he talks about sidestepping the traps. And I've learned to do that as well. There's places where I know there are landmines out there in my relationships with my loved ones at work in daily living. I know they're there. I've set half of my booby traps, but I know that they're there and I can sidestep them as I get closer. So that's generally my definition of emotional sobriety for myself. I'm going to give you a little bit of backstory so you understand where I'm coming from, and talk about how the steps have helped in my process. No emotional recovery, emotional sobriety, 12-step story would be complete without childhood. I'll just tell you, I grew up in chaos and violence and abuse. I grew up in an unstable home. I had both parents kind of take off at certain points in my childhood before I was probably about 8 years old. Went to, live with their side relationships. I've also, lots of police, disturbances that required the police to show up at my house. A lot of just instability, which certainly left an impression on myself. That's why I say, I'm an alcoholic, regardless of the substance, regardless of the alcohol that goes into my system. I can get addicted to anything. Before I picked up my first drink, I wanted to escape. And so I used food and I used video games. I used books and fantasy and anything to escape who I was in the moment. That led me to an early entry into alcohol and drug use. I have two older brothers, so I had the opportunity and I had motive, and certainly with absentee parents, there was plenty of freedom there. And so I started drinking when I was 10 years old. One of my older brothers that summer had some friends over, had some beers out, and he saw me practically staring down the beer. And he said, do you want this? Are you going to be cool about this? And I know what he meant, but I just heard cool and I wanted to be cool. So I said, yes, I hope. Whatever it takes to convince you to give me that thing, because I wanted to be cool and they all looked cool. I didn't feel cool. I wanted to be where they are. So I had my first beer that summer and a couple beers after that. And then I had my first joint in the park that summer, trying to again fit in. And there was no like aha moment. But over time, I got to realize that this stuff helped me escape a lot more effectively than the other stuff I was trying previously. And so my response to the anxiousness and depression and fear that was generated by my childhood upbringing was relieved by these substances, and especially alcohol. And so I'm like, I need this. This is my medicine. This is going to help me. And it did. It helped me. It got me through some very dark times in my preteen years. And the problem is I'm an alcoholic. I'm a nature and nurture alcoholic, meaning by nature, genetically, I've got alcoholism in my family. By nurture or lack of nurture, circumstances, environmental stuff also played a part and led me up there. Doesn't make me an alcoholic, other than it set the stage for me to become an alcoholic. Once I put the substance into my body, I didn't know where it would leave me. So it's my reaction to alcohol, and a traditional definition of alcoholism applies to me. So I spent the next 8 years basically mixing and matching substances and circumstances to try to make myself feel better. And eventually that ran out. I wound up doing harder substances. No surprise there. I was like a poster child, for what happens when, good kids, use alcohol as a gateway, a substance. And I could have been an after school special, is what I'm saying, for, a public service announcement. And, at the end of the line, I was, wanting to end my life because I thought I was going to be hopelessly addicted for the rest of my life. I was 18 years old. I had flunked out of college. I was back to working for my dad, and doing a lot of lying, cheating, stealing to continue to use and get what I needed in order to continue to just deaden the feelings and not feel the emotions behind what I was doing. So all the guilt and shame and remorse kicked in because I was doing all this, this stuff that was not contrary to who I was, that spirit inside me was really suffering as a result of the way I was living. So long story short, I wind up in a rehab, at 18 years old. I decide that my way doesn't work, your way, AA's way, 12-step way, seems much better option than what I had learned. And I saw an opportunity there. I saw some hope for someone who thought their life was over at 18. The idea of turning it around and getting some hope was really fundamental to my deciding I'd hit my bottom and that I wanted to continue this journey. So I started my 12-step, recovery journey at that point. And for me, it was, typical recovery story. 90 meetings, 90 days, get a home group. I moved out of, my parents' house, which had all kinds of risks there in terms of, my mom who was drinking and my friends and brothers who were drinking. And so I started a fresh life and took a risk and wound up, moving to a different part of my state and meeting some great people who brought me to meetings and the diner afterwards. And the fellowship was wonderful. And I got a commitment and a home group, and it was very good for a while. My problem is that I'm one of those alcoholics who needs a spiritual experience in order to maintain my recovery, that I need to have that change of attitude, that change of perception, that change of reaction to life in order to stay sober. That 12th step needed to occur, because otherwise I was going to be miserable. And I was miserable, actually, because I hadn't worked the steps. And this is my first cautionary tale, is that I waited too long to do the step work, that, I had done 1, 2, 3. I had a passing knowledge of the steps. I had looked at it and gotten it kind of this look at the steps on the wall, go, I'll do that one, that one, that one. And they said, take what you need and leave the rest. And I did. The problem is I left a lot and I didn't know what I needed. And so I had approached step work in a very haphazard and almost deadly way, because I had gotten to 5 years sober and was suicidal all over again. I had no tools for living. My emotions were driving me. They were absolutely in control. Just like in late term alcoholism, active alcoholism, the alcohol was driving me. My emotions were driving me. My circumstances were driving me. And I didn't have any tools or ability to manage all that. So I'd hit 5 years and was in that kind of state. And what I love about the AA literature is it's just chock full of reference material and stuff that no matter when I look at it, I go back and I'll reread it and take a look at other stuff. I go, oh my God, that applies to me. And so with 5 years in the program, going to meetings and commitments, all that stuff, I was suffering from the bedevilments. Now, Bill writes about the bedevilments in We Agnostics and on page 52, and there's supposed to be an argument for a higher power. And in a way, he's talking about the circumstances before we get into the program. But here I was 5 years in, and subsequently other times when that happened, where the bedevilments were occurring to me sober. And so things like I was prey to misery and depression, feeling of uselessness, full of fear, unhappy, anxious, depressive, just like I was early on before I even came to the program. And all this stuff was happening to me all over again. So luckily I got some additional help, outside help. And I also did my fourth step. And I did my first fourth step. It was pretty in depth. I kind of built up this stuff for too long, and I wound up doing a long fifth step with my sponsor and getting the relief as promised. And that's another thing which has amazed me about the program, is it delivers. You do the work, you get the results, and I'm living proof of that. So I got through my fifth step, and I go through the rest of the work, and things are pretty good for a while. I gotten over the kind of the initial hump and gotten some relief from my isms, right? And gotten through 6 and 7 and done some some 8 and 9 work and made some amends and was trucking along. But I hit another wall at 10 years, and I'm sitting there. I'm like, where is this Happy Joyce and Free they're talking about? Where is this, the rest of these promises? Why do I still feel like an incomplete sober person? And so I had to take another look at where I was with these steps and take a look at what I was holding back on. And what I found was that although I had done, fourth and fifth step and eighth and ninth step, there were still things I was holding back on. There were still resentments that I refused to let go of. And I used the excuse that my problem is that these people deserve it. Bottom line. I was a kid. I didn't deserve to be abandoned. I didn't deserve to be abused. These people deserve to have my resentments. They deserve to be never forgiven and me holding them, in jail in my head over and over again. The problem is I was the only one suffering from this. I couldn't have a relationship because I was tied up in the past. I was carrying those ghosts around with me. And it wasn't until I had let go absolutely and I had worked on the forgiveness that I needed to do and let go of those resentments that I had towards those people that I really got the relief that the program offers. It's not easy, but I had to first look at those relationships and what had happened. I also had to, look at what was my part in it. And that was my problem. I kept hearing like, what's your part? Clean up your side of the street. And I went back and I looked and I had no part in it when it started, but I had a part in it. And in the literature, it says, what was our mistake? And my mistake was carrying these resentments decades later, not allowing them to be free, not letting forgiveness and grace to enter that relationship into those people. Because all I was hurting myself. I've heard resentments described as setting myself on fire, waiting for the other person to die of smoke inhalation. No, that wasn't going to happen as long that freedom wasn't going to happen until I had put that fire out and forgive those people. And it has nothing to do with right or wrong. It has to do with me wanting to live, me wanting to be free. And this was my path to freedom. And the one thing which stuck out to me that really made a huge difference is the St. Francis prayer. And I use the St. Francis prayer as a daily meditation on this in order to start to see where being of service and being of love and being of peace was really what my calling was and what the ability to forgive other people had to do with letting that spirit flow through me. And eventually I got that freedom and I got that peace and I was able to let all that go. So yeah, getting through intractable resentments really was a huge chunk for me, and that's really I think where I started to look at emotional sobriety and started to pick up the threads of where it was referred to and where it was coming from outside of my kind of my daily practice. And so as I moved through my teenage years of sobriety and got to go through the work a couple more times, I started to see these things keep popping up over and over again. I'd go, seek out, like it says in 11, sought through prayer and meditation, conscious contact with a higher power. So I started reading different spiritual books and spiritual practices and listening more. And I started to hear some universal truths come out. And so, I saw Bill Wilson's letter about emotional sobriety. I'm like, oh, this is starting to make sense. He started to apply the steps to gain emotional sobriety. And about 15 years ago, I found Alan's a recording of Alan's that someone had passed along to me, and I'm like, this guy's got, you know, got something going on here that made a lot of sense. And then a few years ago, you know, probably 3 years ago now, I think Alan's name popped up again, and I listened to his CD that he had with Herb K, I think, about emotional sobriety. So all these dots started to line up, and I started to go, this is what this means. And so I started to take deeper dives into things like selfishness and self-centeredness and my resentments and fears, like it's talked about in the big book in steps 3 and 4. And rolling over that, you know, kind of reading it on a regular basis, a couple times a year, working with sponsees, but also working with a sponsor myself, that set of pages, you know, talk about steps 3 and 4 in the big book, it is absolute gold. You know, Bill Wilson talking about selfishness and self-will and how that drives us to start to cling to things and relationships and try to, and how I try to get what I want and manage the situation. You know, me clinging and controlling and managing is probably one of the worst places for me to be emotionally, because then I'm highly connected to the outcome. When I'm highly connected to the outcome, that's when I leave myself open to disappointment. Even if it comes out the way I want, it may not come out the time I want, and sometimes the manner I want, or I get it and I'm not interested in it anymore. It doesn't satisfy. So again, going back to the book, and like realizing there's some universal truths here. Probably about 10 years ago, I'd done a workshop with a couple of friends, an AA workshop, and my portion of the conversation was titled "Bring a Shovel," because we're going to dig some stuff up here. I had to realize that there was stuff that was buried, but it was, you know, sorry for the analogy. It was shallow, right? Very shallow hole that I dug and just threw some dirt on top and threw some leaves on that and pretended it wasn't there. And, you know, I found out that when I tried to use an emotional bypass or a spiritual bypass and just go, oh, you know, I can turn this over to God, or, you know, they did the best they could with what they had, that wasn't enough. I need to spend the time and actually grieve those moments. There's nothing wrong with, in a process for me, to grieve my childhood, to grieve the loss of a mother. Even though she was physically there, there were lots of moments where it was not a, you know, a mothering experience and a protective experience. And same thing. All these experiences, I had to go through a grieving process, and then I could properly move on from them. The way I've worked through that, and I'll talk through some highlights and some step work here, just because I found it really important. Bill's talk on steps 3 and 4 is crucial for me. His writing here on the bottom of 66, and sorry, I don't have slides. I'm not that polished. The bottom of 66, he talks about the wrongdoings of others, fancy or real, had power to actually kill. And that phrase jumped out at me, because I had to admit that maybe some of the wrongdoings I had attributed to people were fancy, that were made up, that I had this delusional story about what had happened to me, and that I was applying what I thought your motivation was and your response to life. So, you know, the analogy of being stuck in traffic is always used. It's like, the guy cuts me off because he hates me, right? It's not like he's late for work. You know, those are the types of things. But even a much deeper part, when the closer those relationships get, the bigger story I have made up. And of course, the next paragraph, this was our course. We realized that the people who had wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick, though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us. Those to service, they, like us, were sick too. I had to look at the fact that I'm a soul in this world doing the best I can with some tools, trying to, find a path through life. I'm stepping on people's toes. I'm causing discomfort, and I want to be forgiven, right? When, you know, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I bought the wrong yogurt last night. and it almost escalated because I wanted to defend the fact that, you know, that I, you know, how I bought the wrong yogurt. But, you know, I go, you know, if I want to be forgiven, then I need to forgive. You know, that if I'm making mistakes, and I do, I make a lot of mistakes, and I have all these tools. I have so much wealth of knowledge of 32 years of sobriety and step work and spiritual, you know, awakening and spiritual readings. And I'm messing up on the regular. How am I expecting other people to behave and perform exactly as I want them to in order to satisfy my demands? That's insanity. And so, you know, a simple line like that, that perhaps they were sick too, is a reminder that, okay, we're all human in this. We're all doing our best. Even if we're not doing our best, what am I going to do about it? Am I going to hold a resentment? Am I going to lash out? That's only going to hurt me. So that writing in there was huge. The other thing, which I talked about resentments, and when I look at my resentment list, and I look at the things that happened, when I get hurt, I've got a moment in time to respond to it, right? I talked about responding versus reacting, and I can go, oh, that hurt my feelings, that caused some fear. I'm upset, angry at somebody. I've had a moment in time, depending on how much, you know, how spiritual I am that day, is how long that window of time stays open, right? Sometimes it's short, a couple minutes, sometimes it's a couple hours, but I get sore and I get hurt, and this is all normal. But when I am out of sorts and not in a spiritually connected and not feeling emotionally recovered, that hurt goes on for much longer. I want to be, in terms of, you know, like a legal analogy, like I'm the prosecutor, judge, and jury of, you know, this person did me wrong. I'm going to put them on trial in my head. I've got a whole conversation with them, and, you know, I'm going to convict them. But then I want to keep convicting them, right? It'd be bad enough if I did that once. And who am I to you know, take someone's inventory and make those judgments against them and convict them. But, you know, in the U.S., we've got a thing called double jeopardy, which means you can't be tried for the same thing twice. I want to keep trying you over and over again. I want to, you know, relive that thing, especially if I think I'm right. That's even worse. Sometimes I'd rather be wrong, because then I at least I can, chalk it up to, oh, I was mistaken, and move on. But when I'm right, it's even worse, because then I feel like I'm justified in my behavior. Those are all pitfalls and traps for me. And thankfully, you know, I've been using 10, 11 steps to work through those over the years. So as I move through these steps, I find out that 6 and 7, in terms of my character defects, the one good thing about being sober doing this work over and over again for a long time is I've got a pretty clear picture of my character defects. The bad news is I've got a pretty clear picture of my character defects. I know where they are, and I know where the stumbling blocks are. And I know if I don't keep on top of certain, prayer meditation practices, that they'll pop up again stronger than other days. But the other piece of it is, you know, I've developed a spiritual tolerance, that I want to be better, you know, and this is the work. It's like I go from having to do 6 and 7 because my character defects are absolutely eating me up inside. And I get that look again from, you know, from my friends and loved ones when I'm being an ass and being, you know, sarcastic or critical, you know, and I don't want that look again. I don't want to get that disapproving look and, you know, the sigh from my wife. So I do the work in 6 and 7 to try and, you know, to reduce my harms that I do with these behaviors. And then over time, it's not because I have to do the work. It's because I like to do the work because I'm starting to love the results. I like a refined Tom. I like an improved Tom. It's easier to live in the skin of an improved me because I'm more connected with you and I'm causing less harm and I'm being more of service. So when I look at 6 and 7, it's almost like a mini steps 1, 2, 3 on my character defects. I have to admit what they are. I have to identify that I'm powerless over them, that they're dominating me. I have to believe I could be relieved of my character defects, right? So step 2, that I could be restored to sanity with these character defects. And then step 3 is I have to turn them over to my higher power. And I also have to be vigilant when these things come up that I have a choice sometimes of if I'm going to act out on them or not. And that's a process I work on. Mini 1, 2, 3 in the middle of a character defect. The other thing that was really big for me, and it shows up in the 12 and 12, is humility. Again, clear understanding of who I am, right? Clear understanding that I have this personality and that there are certain sore spots and that I know where I can get better. I know where I'm going to get stuck. And humility has been a huge part of the last time through the 12 and 12. And when I read it through again recently, it kept coming up over and over again. You know, I have potential. My higher power has, you know, my spiritual nature is inside of me and pretty pure. And I have a lot of junk in front of it. And humility is knowing what that junk is and making an honest effort to kind of clear up as much as possible so I can be the spiritual man that's in my higher power intends me to be. So that humility is important. And also, it gives me an opportunity to say, well, maybe I'm wrong. You know, letting go of this a sense of self and defensiveness. Because I found out, hey, I was wrong about alcohol and drugs, and I was also wrong about those resentments, and I'm, you know, kind of wrong about, you know, needing to be in power and control and manage my life. So if I'm wrong about those stuff, what else am I wrong about? You know, it's a huge amount of freedom to find out that I could possibly be wrong about other things, and that I could that I can give those up too. And if I'm possibly wrong about things, I'm willing to be humble and listen to other people's perspective on them, then I don't have to defend my position anymore. And that's probably one of those character defects, which, you know, really kicked my butt is even if I knew I was wrong, I'd defend myself. If I knew I was right, I'd defend myself more. And I found that through this work that I don't have to defend myself, that it's not important for me to be right, to prove I'm right, and that I can just let it go. Because that whole piece is tied up with my ego. And when I, you know, fall back into, you know, ego and self, there's where my trouble kicks in. So 6 and 7, again, has been a iterative process, wonderful opportunity. I never thought I'd like it. And you know, that's, I mentioned it in, I think one of my talks is I never intended to be a spiritual guy. It just, you know, first I got my butt kicked enough that I had to do this work. And then I liked the results and I continued on. So in a way, you know, this program has given me, you know, a perspective, which I never thought I'd have. I talked about 8 and 9, the importance of making amends and the freedom that brings. I made amends to people that I were on my never list, you know, especially my dad, who I had a lot of reservations about making amends to him. And again, getting sober young and being in sobriety a while, all it means is my amends about my using days, my drinking days are kind of small, right? I caused some damage. I did some stuff. It's the amends I make later on when I'm supposed to be sober, you know, and 10 years in, 12 years in, you know, and I'm stumbling off the same thing. And I've got to do a fourth step again with somebody. That's humbling. But I was able to do both, both an amends at the beginning of my recovery and midway through. And my dad, who I would never have thought I'd forgiven him, you know, the violence I saw from him in our household and his, it's not his inventory, it's mine. So I'll just say that I had trouble, and this is where the amends comes in, is I had trouble with relationships with other men because I didn't make amends to my dad and I couldn't forgive my dad. I couldn't have clean in the moment relationships with women because I was holding back and not making amends and forgiving my mom. It is hard for me to be in the moment and respect you and be present for you if I'm dragging my ghosts around. Bottom line. So I can have relationships today with friends, with loved ones, and I'm with you. I'm not with my mom, my dad, that guy, the abuser, any of that stuff. I'm with you today. And that was probably the biggest freedom that comes from my eighth and ninth. And then 10, 11, 12, I'll just say that, there's some big pieces there, and I could talk forever about the step work and how important it is, and I'll try and just sum it up. You know, 10 gives me the ability to do inventories, spot check inventory. Am I off track on this? Pause in my tracks, given the ability to make direct amends. And that took time as well. Early on, I would go, oh, I did something wrong. I need to make amends to that guy. I'll wait till I see him again. Oh, good. He wasn't at that meeting on Friday. I'll see him next Friday. This is at the home group. And then I'm then carrying that around for a month. I've learned the value of make amends right away. Pause if possible. Stop in the middle of the behavior of making amends. It is freeing. And that's what I'm looking for from this recovery stuff, is being free. It also removes the blockers. You know, I've been, I mentioned my problem is that when I have these character defects, these resentments, these harms done to you in the way of my relationship with you, it blocks me. It blocks me from my higher power. It blocks me from you, and it blocks me from myself, because I carry around the emotional baggage that's related to that. So 10 gives me that quick relief that I need in order to get back and get clear. 11th step, I'll just say that, St. Francis prayer was huge for me in my transformation. Meditation is really important. And I'll talk about that again in a second. And 12th step is the payoff, right? I've learned that, first of all, in the 12 and 12, it says, or is it in the big book, it says nothing will ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. That, number one, is a great promise and something I want. So I do a lot of service work with other alcoholics. I enjoy it. It's a huge blessing for me to turn what was a lifetime of what I thought was going to be useless suffering into a channel of God's love and peace. And then, I also get to get all the benefits. You know, in step 12, it talks about emotional sobriety, right? It talks about being of usefulness to others. In the 12 and 12, it's like one of my favorite sections. It talks about the service gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help, the knowledge that at home and in the world outside, we are partners in the common effort, the well-understood fact that in God's sight, all human beings are important, the proof that love freely given surely brings a full return. And it goes on and on. I don't want to take up more of the time, but like that in itself, when I read that, like, that's it. Like, these are the things that 12-step work, deep 12-step work, getting to a place of emotional sobriety gets me to. And the last thing I'll mention is, like, if I bring up kind of three things which help me keep anchoring this, it is, again, humility, the ability to see putting the horse before the cart the way it's supposed to be, being of service and consulting and connecting with others in my higher power and being open to correction and understanding my true nature, that humility, hugely important. Second is forgiveness, and that is both for the past and the present. What's happening in the moment, I can let go. It's my choice, right? How long I want to hang on to it, it's my choice. How long do I want to suffer? My choice. Forgiveness has been key. And finally, I mentioned in kind of step 11 is mindfulness. I spent most of my life in an emotional blackout, right? Reacting to life, just not being aware. How did those words leave my mouth? I did it again, you know, whatever it might be. In order to recover from emotional blackouts, I need to be mindful. I need to be present. And the mindfulness practice that I've incorporated into my life has given me that ability, you know, just a little space for me to be present in my daily life before I react and act out again. So I've been talking for a really long time. I hope this helped frame up a little bit about how the step work can lead me to some emotional sobriety, to recovery from my past, the ability to live in the present without getting hung up. And I want to thank everyone for being here today. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Tom.